I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Between a hurricane, a gushing oil well, oh, and a weak economy, several Gulf Coast beach communities have a lot to contend with before this coming holiday weekend. Hurricane Alex is not expected to affect BP's ruptured well, but it is creating rough seas that have pushed more oil onto beaches, including, for the first time, at least seven beaches in Mississippi. So far, cleanup crews have scooped up more than a ton of sand mixed with tar. Bobby Weaver is Harrison County's Sand Beach Director, which includes Biloxi and Gulfport. Thanks for being with us, Bobby.
Thanks for having me.
And let's talk about what it looks like on the beaches there that you're in charge of. We understand that there are like tar paddies and mats and balls. So what do they look like?
Well, the mixture of what we're getting as far as a shoreline impact or anything maybe from a quarter-inch size tar ball to maybe a tar patty that's, you know, 6-8 inches in diameter, and it's, I don't know, you could, some resembles a cookie, or, you know, down here pralines are pretty good to eat, and they got that resemblance of that color appearance, a brownish orange appearance. It's soft. It does harden as it sets on shore and the temperature's cool.
And how many of them are there?
You couldn't count. It's fragmented and it stretches for miles in areas. One common thing we have noticed is each day beach impact is further and further west. So our good friends to the west, Hancock County, probably will experience it maybe this afternoon or possibly sometime tomorrow.
Now, how many people do you have working on the beach to pick these up and to try to clean things up quickly?
The contractor that's been assigned to work the beaches of Harrison and Hancock County has 1,700 employees that's on standby, and they operate out of a staging area a little bit inland. And I think yesterday we had 600 people deployed on our beaches. They're working right now on getting final approval to have a rotating shift to where we either do a night operation into the night or possibly do a 24/7 operation.
And what exactly do they do to get it off the beach?
Basically come down here with rakes and shovels and just try to just get the oil. Certainly they're getting a little bit of sand intermingled with it and put it in plastic bags, put them on four-wheelers, take them to a dumpster, truck picks it up, takes it out to a staging area before they take it to its final disposal site.
You were out on a boat today testing, I understand, oil-eating microbes that might be able to be used here. Can you tell us about that?
What it is it's a boom. Instead of the typical boom, which has got a vinyl panel that extends down below the float, this is more like mops. Just think of a mop, and it's just lined with mop strands. And they inject the microbes into those strands. So as oil would come in and get intermingled into the strands of the boom, the microbes would be able to go ahead and eat and minimize the extent of the oil as it's being collected. Now, this process isn't new as far as the microbes. We've got naturally microbes in our water columns anyway, and they do some work if it were to get into the marsh. But, you know, sometimes what's there might not be sufficient to combat the influx of oil. So, you know, the discussion is, well, let's just go out there and spread these microbes into the water column and let them do their things. It's a little surprising why more and more of it's not being done.
Well, why wouldn't it be? Is it expensive?
That I don't know. We are not able to get that answer out of the Unified Command.
What's it been like for you to try to deal with all of this in the cleanup and try to prepare for a holiday and do all of these other things? Has it been tough?
It's been a long, frustrating process. You keep in mind, we're in day 70-something now, so you can imagine, you know, the workload and the frustration of not being able to get all your answers, you know, to your questions. Our situation is different than the situation in Alabama and in Florida. We've got different shorelines. We've got different wave actions. So we're able to deploy a little bit different strategy than they are able to deploy. We're encouraging them to do a little bit more in the near shore waters. As this floats in, you know, we don't have a big surf, so it floats in. It might take an hour or two once you spot it offshore. Well, get out there with some skimmer nets, swimming pool skimmers, and pick it up out the water and put it in bags. That way it keeps from getting onto your shoreline of your beach. So we've got a little opportunity to adapt the strategy and make sure that what does occur, you know, is most effective.
All right. Bobby Weaver is Harrison County's Sand Beach Director in Mississippi. He's been talking with us about cleanup efforts on the beaches there from the Gulf oil leak. Bobby, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We want to look back now on what we may have learned from two oil spills that happened 41 years ago. In January 1969, an oil rig blowout off the coast of Santa Barbara, California, spilled about 3.5 million gallons of crude into the water. It washed up onto 35 miles of beach and inspired the modern environmental movement. Then in September that same year, an oil barge ran aground off Cape Cod, Massachusetts, spilling 200,000 gallons of diesel. With us are two men who were there. Rod Nash is Professor Emeritus at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Welcome, Rod.
Thank you very much. Pleasant to be here.
Also with us is George Hampson. He's an oceanographer emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, and he was one of the first researchers on the scene of the Cape Cod oil spill. Welcome to you too, George.
Thank you very much, and I'm also glad to be here.
All right, Rod, can you still see the oil from the 1969 spill in Santa Barbara?
Well, you can see the oil on rocks. You can also see oil that is, let's say, naturally seeping from the floor of the Santa Barbara Channel. And Chumash Indians have been gathering it for thousands of years. And anybody who's lived in Santa Barbara always has a can of kerosene by their back door to clean their feet when they get back from the beach, because we have oil on the beach. We have oil on the beach all the time. The problem, of course, with the 1969 spill is we had a lot more oil than we were accustomed to, and it came very quickly.
What about in West Falmouth, Massachusetts, George? A salt marsh was hit hard by the spill there in 1969, and I understand that in some places you can still smell oil.
I'm going to start by saying that this environment has really cleaned up most favorably. To the untrained eye, you'd never be able to know we had an oil spill right now. But parts of the marsh, there's a soft sediments now, way off the main harbor, and that's where the oil can be found, approximately 15 centimeters below the surface, 6 inches below the surface. You can still smell number two fuel.
So scientists can still find evidence of this spill 41 years later?
Correct.
Rod, I'd like to ask you, how long did it take for the beach to at least appear normal in Santa Barbara, and when were people allowed to go in the water?
Our spill continued for well over a year. We had the same problem that we're having in the Gulf right now, and shortcuts and regulatory problems occurred that created what was called a blowout. The oil continued for a long time. It never really stopped. It sort of eventually bled itself out, which is kind of a scary thought when you think about what's going on in the Gulf. It appears to me that the oil in Santa Barbara was a much heavier quality than what I'm seeing in the footage from the Gulf. We had 2 or 3 inches of oil, it seems to me, floating on the water in the Santa Barbara Harbor. It really was a black tide. I look at a little sort of sheen on the water in the Gulf. I see President Obama picking up a little piece of seaweed. If he'd been out there, he would have been wading through 2 or 3 inches of very dark black crude oil. To me, the impact was greater in Santa Barbara initially.
And then how long did it take for the beaches to start to look normal again? And how long did it take before people, you know, felt comfortable at least going in the water?
You know, the beaches were covered with oil, and that oil had to be scraped into huge piles using straw, very messy business. Then there had to be a place to find to dump it. And I recall we found one dump that the oil began to seep from that dumping site right back into the ocean again. So it was dirty business. But within a year, it was fine, and oil remained on the rocks, particularly above the high tide line. But below the high tide line, the working of the strong Pacific tides and winds pretty well cleared it up. It would take a very trained professional eye to discern the impact of the spill today. And I would say that was probably true five or 10 years after the spill in Santa Barbara.
And George, why don't you describe for us what it looked like off Cape Cod right after the spill there in 1969?
It happened at night. It was a foggy night, and the spill came into the shoreline in West Falmouth, Massachusetts, in Buzzards Bay, and then it migrated slowly down to Wild Harbor River. That's an estuary, and that's where the marshes are and so forth. And it proceeded to interfere with swimming fish, eels and flounder, all kinds of fish were swimming aimlessly on the surface. And then when it got up into the marsh, all the invertebrates started coming out of the sediment. Remember now, this is a number two fuel. It's most dangerous. It's most toxic. So it impaired almost all the invertebrates into that system. Took time for the animals to all come out of the sediments, but when they did, all the tide pools were filled with invertebrates. It was the most massive situation that I've ever seen.
So it was like worms and clams and...
Any kind of crustaceans. They're the most sensitive. The worms are next. And then there's other creatures probably less sensitive. And we also had these little crabs which burrow into the sediment. They're called fiddler crabs. And they were all on the surface. Clams, soft-shell clams, had their siphons extended 2 or 3 inches. And that continued for days. And then slowly, as time passed, the animals died. And then there was a period of days and weeks of very, very quiet sounds of nothing. The birds were not feeding, and it just reminded me of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. In this case, it was a silent fall. And offshore, we had dead lobsters and traps up to 42 feet in depth of water.
And how long would you say it was, George, before it started to at least appear normal?
Yeah, we tracked that very, very carefully. We took a lot of samples, and we were sampling after 3 years. And towards that third year, we started getting things coming back to normal. The original animals were not present. And slowly, the more opportunistic species, which means an invertebrate that is able to invade. And then what happens is they get forced out, and then other animals come in and either prey upon them or force them out. But it took 2 or 3 years.
I'd like to ask both of you this question. Some folks say, you know what, nature will take care of this, and human intervention may not be as necessary as we think it is because beaches recover. Rod, I'd like to start with you. What do you say to that? Do beaches recover? Seemingly, in your case, within a year, everyone was back in the water off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Right. I don't think people being back in the water is really the criteria to measure here. I think it's the health of the marine ecosystem and the non-human species that really bothers me the most. But yeah, nature recovers. And I think it's well to remember that the spill in Santa Barbara and the spill in the Gulf was a natural substance. It wasn't a manufactured substance like George describes, number two diesel. My feeling is that the ecosystem eventually will absorb it. Other creatures will die. They will come back, and you will have recovery. This is not to say that we're not to blame for it or that we should not feel badly about it or learn lessons from it, but it is to make a distinction between a natural substance and what you might call a biocide, pesticide, or poison.
That's Rod Nash, Professor Emeritus at the University of California at Santa Barbara. We're looking back at two oil spills and what they may tell us about what's happening in the Gulf right now. We'll have more after a break. And later in the show, Summer Camp Without Technology. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Oil giant BP came under fire again today, this time during a congressional hearing on a new law designed to prevent oil spills like the one in the Gulf. Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey pointed out that BP's disaster response plan does not mention hurricanes or tropical storms, something Markey says proves that the oil giant is not prepared to handle crises. Well, how have oil companies responded to spills in the past? Joining us to help answer that question in the context of two 1969 oil spills are Rod Nash, a wilderness historian and professor emeritus at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He helped found the university's environmental studies program after the spill there. Also, George Hampson, an oceanographer emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. He was one of the first researchers on the scene of the spill there. And George, what do you say to folks who say that nature takes care of most toxins and the beaches will eventually recover?
I certainly agree with that. There's only one problem, is that it takes a long time for nature to really take all the oil out of the sediments. But one of the things that's happening down in the Gulf is that's called a sweet oil. It has it has components in that oil that are quite toxic. And so with that in mind, I worry about that oil behaving in similar fashion to the number two fuel that we had, because that is definitely going to happen if it gets into the soft sediments. It will impact those soft sediments. Nature will take care of it. Man can help, no question about it. But sometimes we get carried away. We introduce heavy equipment, blasting of hot water and things like that. It just is wasting money. That's my opinion.
What would you say? I'd also like to ask both of you this question. What would you say is the main lesson that we may have learned from the spills in 1969 that can be applied to the Gulf today? Rod, what would you say?
I would say that we learned that the supervisory and the regulatory network that was supposed to protect us in the Santa Barbara area failed. And I think it also has failed in the Gulf.
Right.
And I don't think we've learned a darn thing over those 40 years. Santa Barbarans were very worried about offshore drilling. Here's a world-famous tourist beaches. Here's a world-famous resort community. You're putting rigs a few miles right off those beaches. And we said, please, federal government, please, Department of the Interior, please think about what might happen if there was a blowout. And we were told not to worry. No problem. We've got this nailed. We can do this technology.
I concur with what Rod said. And the thing is about human nature is you slowly forget. You know, time passes, 10 years, and you go back to the old techniques. And that's the thing that worries me.
So we didn't learn anything?
You've got to have a system in place that says your tires on your car will be in good shape when you drive. And you have to get an inspection sticker for that. The same analogy for oil is that you have to have these preventers in place.
So we haven't learned anything. It's like Groundhog Day.
I would agree.
Huh.
Haven't learned very much. What we have learned is that local people, like those who are outraged now in the Gulf, are perhaps the best people to stand up and speak for the natural world.
George, you liken what you did to study what happened off Cape Cod to fighting big tobacco on the dangers of cigarettes. Why is that?
We were fighting an uphill battle. The fact that no matter what we proved, no matter what we showed, it was going to be termed as it was something else that caused the mortality of these animals. Well, I'd lived here all my life, practically, and I'd never seen anything like this. And so it wasn't the wind. It wasn't the amount of dispersants that they released. We feel as if we showed for the first time scientifically that we had long-term impacts from oil.
And what about predictions for the Gulf? What would both of you say to that? What do you think is going to happen there? Rod?
You know, what is it, 72 days now that that this has been going? I'm very concerned that this 72 days is just the tip of the iceberg.
George, what about your predictions for the Gulf? What would you say?
I will tell you that I have to turn my positive side on now, is that I hope that people will learn from this. And I'll tell you something, those folks down there with all that fishing industry, you know, and we have one captain take his own life because of this. You know, that's very, very bad. And, you know, as far as the people who are going to correct this, you got the best people in the world working there. They have all the techniques. You know, the Coast Guard doesn't have those techniques. The federal government don't have those techniques. It's the oil companies. So we have to put their faith in them. I hate to say that, but we have to put the faith that they're moving ahead as fast as possible to stop this.
I think I don't have very much faith in the oil companies. I believe with George that they would like this spill to go away quickly, but I think the public looking at Santa Barbara, looking at the Gulf situation, would say we've learned very little. We need to try to use the Gulf spill as a tool for rethinking our dependency on oil as a civilization. I think that we have to use it as a tool to revise our ethics a little bit and say, you know, this is not just a waste and not just uneconomic, but it may be ethically wrong for one species to foul the nest of so many others. we really need to look carefully at our trusteeship and our stewardship role vis-a-vis the natural environment.
All right, Rod Nash, wilderness historian and professor emeritus at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he helped found the Environmental Studies Program. Rod, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure, thank you.
And George Hampson is an oceanographer emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. George, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Western intelligence officials believe Yemen has replaced Iraq as al-Qaeda's main base in the Middle East. They point to this month's attack on a government office as the latest sign of that. In a bold daytime raid on one of Yemen's security headquarters in the port city of Aden, 11 people were killed and several al-Qaeda operatives being held there were freed. The attack has raised concerns that Yemen's weak central government can't deal with al-Qaeda or other militant groups operating in Yemen. The BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
The sound of al-Qaeda in Yemen. This is their propaganda video, uploaded onto the internet in April. It shows bearded gunmen milling around an empty desert, and then it cuts to this man, Omar Farouk Abdul Muttalib, the Nigerian jihadist who allegedly trained with al-Qaeda in Yemen, then smuggled explosives on board a flight to Detroit last December.
Well, what happened for this Mr. Abdul Muttalib, it opened the eyes.
Mohammed Taha Mustafa is Yemen's ambassador to Britain.
I think Yemen is now serious about facing this issue of al-Qaeda. There should be an understanding also from our friends in the USA and Europe. They should deal with Yemen and with the Yemen government rather than, you know, just bombing by themselves.
The ambassador means this: the CIA's unmanned Reaper drones, pilotless aircraft launched discreetly from a base in neighboring Djibouti, steered by operators sitting all the way over in Virginia, acting on human intelligence provided on the ground, then firing Hellfire missiles at suspected targets. Last December, the CIA secretly resumed its drone strikes over Yemen after a gap of 7 years. Ginny Hill, a Yemen specialist at the Chatham House think tank, believes this strategy could backfire.
Western policy in Yemen is essentially about ensuring security and stability. But we're seeing a catch-22 situation where kinetic counter-terrorism activity, like drone strikes, is creating such a backlash. It's driving a wedge between the president and the tribes. And it's in danger of actually contributing to instability because of the political tensions that the drone strikes are creating.
The CIA's biggest target in Yemen is this man.
We are wasting our time.
The voice of Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen whose charismatic sermons on the internet in English have inspired a number of jihadist attacks, including the failed one in Detroit. Western intelligence officials believe that partly thanks to his presence there, Yemen has now replaced Iraq as al-Qaeda's new base in the Middle East. Nigel Inkster is a former counter-terrorist official now working at the International Institute of Strategic Studies.
What I think we can say is that the new generation of leadership of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula have shown themselves to be intelligent, energetic, imaginative, and ambitious. Whether that ambition extends to systematic efforts to launch attacks in the West, I think remains to be seen. But certainly they have more capacity to do so, perhaps, than their immediate predecessors.
Al-Qaeda in Yemen appeared to raise the stakes. In a bold dawn raid, gunmen attacked the intelligence headquarters in Aden, killed 11 people and escaped with a number of militants freed from the cells. They now seem to have vanished into the tribal hinterland. So I asked Yemen's ambassador here why it's proving so hard to track down jihadi leaders like Anwar al-Awlaki.
Frank, you know Yemen, and you know the terrain in Yemen, the mountains and the areas, you know. It's very difficult to reach. You have also the tribal tradition, you know. But I can assure you that the government and the security forces are following Anwar al-Awlaki, and Anwar al-Awlaki is on the list to be captured.
Whether or not Anwar al-Awlaki remains at large in Yemen, his jihadist followers there are proving an elusive enemy for the government and its Western allies. Nobody expected them to send a bomber to Detroit, and now nobody seems quite sure what they will attempt next.
That report from the BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner. And this note now from Pakistan. Government officials there are confirming the destruction of six Taliban hideouts in a tribal region located in the northwest frontier province. The aerial assault reportedly killed at least 20 suspected militants. The Pakistani army was bombing that area for months. We'll be back in about 30 seconds. You're listening to Here and Now. Statistics suggest that the average adolescent spends between 6.5 and 8.5 hours a day plugged in. That includes using cell phones, texting, chatting online, surfing the web, social networking sites like Facebook, and playing video games. So what happens when all that is suddenly removed? Well, for millions of American kids going to summer camp this year, that sudden disconnect is about to become a reality. Ann Sheets is with the American Camp Association, and she joins us on the line from Fort Worth, Texas. And Ann, do kids still want to go to camp where the only way to communicate with the outside world is on paper?
Well, Deb, there are so many activities and so many things going on at camp that after just a little while, the reality of being unplugged goes away because they're really too busy to worry about texting and having access to their computers all the time.
A little while. How long does it take usually?
Oh, I think for most kids, once they get into the swing of camp, once they get into the schedule, that by the end of the first day, they're not even thinking about their iPods or computers anymore. There are too many other things to occupy their time.
So nobody's trying to sneak in an iPhone anywhere or anything like that?
Well, most camps have a policy on technology and discourage iPhones or any kind of cell phone. Some even discourage the use of digital cameras, but most camps are not going to let the campers have their cell phones with them.
What would you say? What percentage of camps would you consider unplugged?
I would say that over 70%, based on a study that ACA did recently on emerging issues, 70% reported that they don't allow campers to use electronic technology at camp.
And why is that? What's the reason behind that?
Well, as you mentioned before, that young people between 8 and 18 spend an average of over 7 hours a day just absorbed in media. And there are so many things that can happen at camp in an outdoor setting that children need now. They need to run, they need to jump, they need to play, they need to interact with other kids, and certainly they need to interact with the natural world. And camp is an excellent place to do that.
How do camp directors describe the experience? Do they actually see kids reacting differently, say, when they get to camp as opposed to when they're about to leave?
Yes, when kids are about to leave camp, they generally have a whole new attitude on interaction with others. And most camps, and certainly parents, should ask the policies of the camps related to can the children bring cell phones or any kind of technology with them. And the camps will tell you up front, so parents should prepare their children and let them know that they're not going to have access to their cell phone or their iPod or their BlackBerry.
What about parents? I imagine it's difficult for parents who are used to communicating with their kids using technology. I certainly know I communicate with my teenagers all the time because that's how they communicate. It must be hard for parents as well.
Well, for some it is, but many camps have set up websites where they post photos of the children. They may even have videos. And camps really have to do a balancing act between meeting those needs of technology for instant communication and knowing what's going on instantly and what we would consider the sanctity of the camp experience.
So instead of texting or cell phone use or anything like that, what's happening is they're actually using technology in a way where there can be some sort of a connection. Do they encourage letter writing as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it varies from camp to camp. There's not one standard, but I think most camps encourage the old-fashioned snail mail, as it were, writing letters, which is a lost art, and camp is a great place to have children experience that and learn what it's like to communicate in that way. Some camps may set up one day a week, for example, that the campers can email home. Others will let campers receive email from their parents or others, but will not let the campers email back.
Have you ever had a situation where a camper or their parent just couldn't abide by the rules of no technology?
There are a few people who are always going to try to sneak something in, whether it's a care package that the camp requested not be sent or a cell phone. And each camp is going to handle that differently. I heard one camp director who said the other day, you know, I know you brought your cell phones. I'm going to give you until dinner time to leave them on my bed, and I'll put them away until the end of camp. No questions asked.
So you put
the rule up out front, and then you know there are going to be some people who don't abide by it. So you give them that little amnesty period to turn it in.
And usually it works.
Usually it works. Usually it works.
All right. Ann Sheets with the American Camp Association. She joined us on the line from Fort Worth, Texas. Ann, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Well, just when you thought you might be technologically savvy, another term comes up to make you wonder. We recently came across Thinspiration Twitter updates, mentioned in an article about a study in the American Journal of Public Health. These are basically tweets that urge a person not to eat. And that study in question found that there are some 180 websites that promote eating disorders. 90% of them are open to the public. Some even have their own commandments, such as thou shalt not eat fattening food without punishing oneself afterward. Well, this reminded us of our conversation with young adult fiction writer Lori Hulse Anderson. She explores this obsession in her book Winter Girls. The novel centers around 17-year-old Leah, whose best friend, Cassie, was her partner in the pursuit of thinness.
We went to the mall, and I made sure we used the same dressing room so she could see my skeleton shine in the fluorescent blue light. We went to the food court, and she ordered cheese fries, chicken nuggets, and a salad. I drank black coffee and licked artificial sweetener from the palm of my hand. She asked me to guard the door while she puked lunch into the dirty mall toilet. We held hands when we walked down the gingerbread path into the forest, blood dripping from our fingers. We danced with witches and kissed monsters. We turned us into winter girls, and when she tried to leave, I pulled her back into the snow because I was afraid to be alone.
In Winter Girls, Cassie's struggle ends in death, and Leah continues to spiral downward into mental illness despite the best efforts of her family. Winter Girls author Lori Hulse Anderson is used to addressing serious topics in her novels. Her first book, Speak, which celebrated its 10th anniversary last year, was about the devastating effects of a high school girl's rape. When we spoke to Lori, we asked her what drew her to such dark topics.
Not exactly Pollyanna.
No. I definitely wouldn't call it Pollyanna.
No. I'm actually a very happy person in real life. But I was not a happy teenager. I struggled myself with depression. My family went through some very difficult times starting when I was in eighth grade. And so I really identify and understand teenagers who have things going on in their lives that they can barely articulate, much less make sense of or try to get on top of. And those are the kids who call to me. That's why I write for them.
Right. One thing that strikes me after having read Winter Girls is in the book, you describe these blogs, these online communities where people are encouraging each other in competing, really, in their eating disorders. Now, Speak, which, as we said, was written 10 years ago, then you didn't write about online communities and how they affect teens. Do you think that were you to write Speak now, you'd almost have to include how that online world influences teenagers' social lives?
Absolutely. This has become a central part of our teenagers' lives.
Would you say that for the most part you're trying to warn kids of some of the dangers of online communities?
Well, you know, I think online communities are like communities everywhere. You know, you go into a strange town as a 16-year-old. Hopefully you have somebody in your life who can tell you what's a safe place to go and what's not a safe place to go. I see the internet as the same way. But there are way too many kids out there whose parents either are too busy or who aren't present in their lives, who aren't there to kind of, you know, say, I don't want you in this neighborhood.
Mm. Let's talk about the parents' role here. In Winter Girls, there's an awful lot of talk about parental expectations and and how that may be influencing the teenagers flirting with the dark side. In Leah's case, in the main character Leah's case, the parental pressure that was put on her to be successful, to be like her mother, who's a very successful cardiologist. Do you think that that's a very common problem, and is it affecting girls to the point of mental illness quite frequently?
I think all parents have expectations for their children. Sometimes I've seen a number of upper middle class, upper class families in which that bar is set pretty darn high. If the message that you're getting is, you know, it's AP classes or nothing, it's apply to Ivy League schools or nothing, that's a lot of stress. Parents, you know, I'm in the parent generation, and I think that my generation is a little clueless about, A, how much unhealthy pressure we're putting on our kids, and B, how damaging it can be, you know, which isn't to say that there aren't families who have high expectations and their kids do okay, but I see plenty of cases where mom and dad, they're so interested in getting the right bumper sticker for the Volvo, they kind of lose sight of who their child is and what's really right for their child.
Hmm. Why did you choose eating disorders to be sort of the theme around which you bring up some of these issues in Winter Girls?
Two things happened. I received a lot of mail starting 3 years ago where I was hearing from more and more girls who were in eating disorders and who were cutting, which my generation didn't seem to do that much, but this generation sure does. And also I have a dear friend who's a doctor who kept on bothering me to say that I needed to write a book about eating disorders that might touch the lives of girls the way that Speak has.
Now, why don't you explain cutting for folks who may not know?
It's when a person, not necessarily children, adults do this too, for a lot of complicated reasons, feel that they will feel emotionally better if they hurt their bodies. The most common way to do that is to cut your skin with a razor blade or a knife. What I've been told by people who practice it is in that moment of cutting, there is relief and there is a release.
How did you do the research for this book? It's very raw emotionally.
I interviewed physicians. I interviewed specialists who have worked in eating disorder clinics. I knew people who had been in eating disorders either as adolescents or as adults. I pulled from my own pretty poor self-image at times of the way my body looks, the way I feel in my skin. And I went online to see what people with eating disorders were sharing in online forums. And so that's all that kind of intellectual research approach to the writing. But really, there's this magic moment when a writer sits down and you start to hear the voice, or I start to hear the voice in my head of this character, because it's not me. Leah's not me. Leah's not anybody I met or interviewed. Leah is a fully formed person in this world that's just outside of my reach. And my job for much of the writing of the book was to turn off my intellect and be open to letting her tell her story through me.
You mentioned being able to remember high school, remember what high school was like, and you do speak very well to that meanness of high school. When you're reading the book, you say, oh, I remember how horrible it was to ride to ride on the bus. I mean, just those little things, the clicks and who's in and who's out and who's kicking someone from behind, throwing ho-hos in their lap and all of those things. You really have it right in front in your mind when you're writing. How do you think you do that?
People who know me well would probably tell you that I'm emotionally frozen at age 15. And I stopped maturing then, which in most careers is a negative, but I found the job where it works for me.
Well, do you have fond memories of high school? I know you said your family was going through some tough times when you were that age.
I have fond memories of getting out of high school. For a while there, I was visiting a lot of schools. Somebody once did the math and said that when, especially when Speak had just come out, I think I've spoken to about 500,000 high school students in the last decade, and I tell every single one of them that people who say that high school is the best time of your life, those people are lying to you. They're lying. It's so much easier to be an adult than it is to be a teenager. Right. I don't care what anybody says.